I'm Fathery.
And I'm Jeff.
And this is Text Trek. Okay, as you can see, Dave is not here. He is on an away mission. And he was wearing a red shirt when he beamed away, so maybe he'll be back next week to talk about the next Discovery episode. But we have Jeff over here to talk about Star Trek Discovery Episode 6 with us. Jeff, would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about how you got into Star Trek?
Sure. My name's Jeff. I got into Star Trek at a young age through my dad. We used to watch TOS episodes together. Sometimes I kind of wear it as a badge of honor that I feel like I'm the last generation that grew up saying Star Trek and meaning Star Trek. Next Generation didn't premiere till I was in middle school, so I was into Trek. I had a Mr. Spock uniform t-shirt as a kid. I had that neat Enterprise from the motion picture that you could pull apart and put back together into all the different shapes from the technical manual. So Trek's kind of in my blood. I've loved it for a long time.
Do you have a favorite show? Are you more of a old school TOS guy? Or
see, that is a difficult question because it's a toss up between TOS and TNG. I grew up on TOS. TOS was what I knew, and then Next Generation came out and opened up this whole amazing world of new Star Trek. And so I have very fond memories of both. And depending on when you ask, it's a different show on top each time.
That's how I am when I'm trying to figure out my second favorite Star Trek show. Is it TOS or is it TNG? Because my favorite is Deep Space Nine.
Good show.
But that was the one that was on the air every week when I had first started getting into Star Trek. I was aware of the original series and the Next Generation. I was watching those too, in either in reruns or out getting the VHS tapes. But DS9 and Voyager were on the air, and DS9 was and everyone hated it back then. Everyone was like, yeah, it's my least favorite show. I can't stand it. And then I'm so surprised now that it's gotten so popular in retrospect. But
yeah.
When Next Generation started, did you have like kind of a weird period of adjustment to the changes that they made, the departures from the original series?
Yes, I did, because you know, the uniform colors change and the ship looks like, you know, the lobby in a hotel. Everything's beige and there's potted plants and all that sort of thing. And you know, the captain is this older guy, but it eventually started to grow on me. And I think as a kid, I really imprinted on Geordi as the younger member of the crew who wasn't Wesley. Hmm. You know, Wesley didn't annoy me as much as he annoyed everyone else because I was about the same age. But to me, Geordi represented, this is a young guy right out of the academy, and look, he gets to sit in the captain's chair. So, you know, like in Arsenal Freedom, and a couple times, he gets command of the ship. Yeah. And I thought, wow, here's this guy in his early 20s, you know, and he's running the show. I thought that was awesome.
Interesting. I know Dave also says that he finds Geordi to be more relatable because he's kind of he's very good at like a specific skill set, but then he's kind of socially awkward. And
oh yes, that's very relatable to a lot of us that are big Star Trek fans.
Yeah, it's a more flattering analog than say someone like Reginald Barclay,
right?
But now we have this new show on the air for the first time in 12 years, Star Trek Discovery. How do you feel about Discovery so far? We're 6 episodes into it now.
See, and that's, if you'd asked me at the end of episode 2, I would have had a completely different answer for you. I was a little dubious watching those first 2 episodes. I'm one of those fans that was complaining after the photos came out of the Klingons about the redesign and about why does it have to look this different? Yes, I admit, special effects have come a long way, and there's no reason for them not to be improved, but such a departure I couldn't wrap my head around. So those first 2 episodes, the dark tone, the dark look of the series, and for instance, Burnham's court-martial scene.
Mm-hmm.
She is standing in the darkness, and the officers sitting on her court-martial panel are also shaded in darkness, and I thought to myself, Where in Starfleet would this take place? Why is this being framed in such a way? And then I saw episode 3, and I thought, maybe this show, maybe I'll give this a shot. And then episode 4, and 5, and now I cannot wait for the follow-up episodes. My misgivings have kind of slid off to the side. I'll still complain about the ship designs and the Klingon makeup, but the show has pulled me in. I really dig it.
Yeah, and leading up to the show, Dave and I were covering it pretty thoroughly. Anytime there was a new trailer or an interview with a writer, anything like that. And I did see a lot of things that kind of set off a red alert as far as like Klingon redesigns and stuff like that. But I also saw, really just from hearing what the writers were saying, that I could tell they kind of had like a very good understanding of Star Trek and had a lot of love for it. You have like a guy like Akiva Goldsman who's involved in so many movies and shows and everything. And he's saying, yeah, like, I'm a old-school, diehard Star Trek fan. This is the thing I'm most excited about. And I could tell that there was going to be stuff in there that I liked. But I knew that, like, okay, if you're not looking at this as closely as I am, for most people who aren't podcasting or making videos and really paying attention like I am, yeah, there's a lot of things that are going to look problematic. Mm-hmm. But the whole time I was hoping like people will give the show a shot, and I was thinking a bunch of the Trek fans will get on board. It's funny, we were talking earlier how we both kind of feel the same way about each episode is better than the last, but yet they keep doing things that would rub diehard fans the wrong way, like showing us a not D7 and calling it a D7, or this week we had a holodeck a decade before the original series.
Yes, that was a little shocking. That's technology that, if you're a Canon hound, it should not have been there.
But I do have my explanation that I've already come up with, and that is because the Discovery is a scientific ship that can handle 300 different scientific projects at the same time. This is actually the very first holodeck that's ever been used on a ship.
It very well could be a prototype, brand new technology, and it's actually not that different from things we're using right now.
Yeah. And they've had holograms on the show for the entire time, so it kind of does make sense that they would do this, I guess. Mm-hmm. But the episode titled, what was the name of this episode? Lethe, or yes. Lethe, the river that makes you forget in Greek mythology, Afterlife. So the episode, we start off with, we see Sarek going onto a diplomatic mission, but he runs into some trouble. His ship is sabotaged by a Vulcan radical who is really into logic, and it kind of reminded me of some of the way Vulcans were depicted in Enterprise. Mm-hmm. You still have some of that anti-human, super radical, pro-logic type of sentiments in Vulcan society. And Commander, or not Commander anymore, Michael Burnham, without a rank on the Discovery, she feels his distress. We learn more about their special mind meld connection they have. Discovery has to go rescue Sarek.
Yeah, and what I found was interesting about that was this Vulcan extremist. When we go back to Enterprise in the fourth season and we really get to know the Vulcans in that story arc, the Cyrenites, the ones that are dedicated to true logic, they are the extremists in that mm-hmm. plot arc. And they become the Vulcans we know and love.
Yeah.
And which explains the duplicitous Vulcans from the early seasons of Enterprise. And here we're seeing an even more fundamentalist version of Vulcans sticking to logic. So once the Cyrenites were in power, apparently we got super Cyrenites. Or, you know, they take, you guys aren't serious enough about logic. Let us show you how you're supposed to be serious about logic. I could not imagine a Vulcan suicide bomber.
Yeah.
Before tonight, that took me by surprise.
Also, his suicide bombing technique, it was kind of like, there is a season 3 episode of Enterprise where they meet some religious radicals that was pretty pretty on the nose, talking about the Bush years with radical terrorists that were causing problems in real life. But we do see a suicide bomber on the NX-01 Enterprise. It kind of reminded me of how it was like an organic thing. There was a Kazon on Voyager that did that also. Mm-hmm. But We also got to see some cool Vulcan ships, some cool Vulcan architecture on the planet. It looked a little too green screen CGI-ish at times, but there were other planets that you could see in the sky, like in the motion picture.
That's true. And one of the things I liked about the design of the Vulcan warp shuttle that Sarek was on was that it had an almost complete warp ring, which was the design we saw a lot in Enterprise.
Yeah.
So even though, you know, I complain a lot about the Klingon ship designs, at least the Vulcan ship is paying homage to its lineage from Enterprise.
Yeah, there's some visual continuity with the Vulcan designs. And we learn more about Michael Burnham's backstory and her time on Vulcan. We learned that the attack that we've seen flashbacks to where she was injured with an explosion at the Vulcan Learning Center as a child, those actually caused by some of these terrorist Vulcans that are the logic extremists. And we get a little bit of explanation on how Sarek revived her with that mind meld, which kind of always felt like he was essentially like giving part of his life energy to save her. And so she was actually just like medically dead for like 3 minutes, and he was able to resuscitate her with his Katra.
Which is a fascinating concept. We see all kinds of psychic abilities from various races in Star Trek, and the Vulcans being the ones rooted in logic, one would think they almost wouldn't believe in such a thing, and yet they're the ones capable of doing it. We see the Katra do all sorts of things in Search for Spock and Wrath of Khan that defy logic.
Yeah, but the idea of Katras has always kind of felt a little weird to me, because you are getting into like, you know, metaphysical or spirituality in Star Trek. Like, you know, is it a soul? Like, is this like the soul collector guys from B5? Yeah, would they go after like a Vulcan's Katra? But if you're a person who wants like a more like scientific sci-fi secular explanation, you can kind of lens it through. Oh yeah, it's just like all with telepathy. You have like this consciousness that can be moved from one brain to another. But you know, she calls it a soul graph, I think. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. But I think it really fits into the you know, what we know about Vulcans and how we've seen them use these abilities before. We also learned some really interesting stuff about her graduation from the Vulcan Science Academy and her desire to go into, what was it called, the exploratory?
Yes, it was the expeditionary, not core, the expeditionary
Vulcan NASA. Vulcan, is what it was.
Vulcan, like, NASA.
People who go into space and explore stuff for the planet Vulcan.
Yes.
And I love how like the director of that group had this really cool staff that makes no sense. It looked like what Nero had in Star Trek 09, but I guess it was a deep visual.
It's actually an interesting point.
Yeah, so Romulans have Vulcan lineage. So there's some connection there. Yep. Yeah, and this kind of explains why something that goes all the way back to season 2 of the original series, why Sarek and Spock had so much bad blood when Spock chose not to go to the Vulcan Science Academy, why they didn't talk to each other for so many years, is that Sarek was given an ultimatum. Mm-hmm. You know, you have this foster kid that you've taken in under your wing, this human, this outsider. You also have this half-human Vulcan hybrid son. We kind of don't want humans to take over our culture, take over our organizations we have. So, you can let one of them join our Vulcan NASA, not both of them. He chose his son over his non-biological daughter, and that came back to bite him in the ass, and his son turned out to not even want to do that. So that would pretty understandably, you know, piss someone off, but they're kind of in the wrong the whole time by, you know, secretly picking what kid they want to do what and trying to plan out his son's future. It felt real, though. It felt believable. It fit into what we know about Sarek.
It's true, and something that crossed my mind just now while you were explaining that is the Vulcans have this concept of infinite diversity and infinite combination.
Mm-hmm.
One would think they would welcome diversity into their exploratory core, but much like our current culture, it seems to mean infinite diversity and infinite combination as long as we're still on top.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that the race that came up with that motto is also one of the most monocultural societies in fiction. Pretty much all Vulcans, unless you're Cybok.
Right.
Who was portrayed as a rebel. And then you had those guys on Enterprise Season 1, the Vulcans without logic, who like to mind-meld rape people. Other than that, pretty much all Vulcans act the same. But the whole idea with Sarek, you know, I was wondering why he, at his basically dying when he's injured from that explosion, you know, why would he be thinking about Michael Burnham instead of his son Spock? Like, I know, like, the show is about her, and they can't show Spock, they can only show her, but one of the other characters mentions, you know, like you know, when you're dying like that, you're going to be thinking about your loved ones, and so it's like, why wouldn't he think about Spock? You know, like, there's bad blood between them, but wouldn't he be thinking about that? And then when I saw what really happened, it was like, oh, well, this is the moment that he regrets most in his life.
That was his largest regret, was making that call.
And it, you know, again, like I said, like, it really explains why he would be so mad at Spock, because it's not like, you're not doing what I want you to do. You know, you're embarrassing me by not going to the Vulcan Science Academy and joining Vulcan NASA. It's more like, you just made the sacrifice that we demanded of your foster sister. You just completely negated that. And I could have picked her, and she would have been grateful. You know, she would have loved this opportunity. But I chose you, and you're just going to throw it away.
And, of course, with Sarek's stoicism, he would never have mentioned any of that to Spock.
Yeah, and I can already see some people complaining about, you know, like, why did we never hear this before or have it explained or anything like that? And, you know, this is, I've brought this up before, but in keeping in tradition, Vulcans, or at least this Vulcan family, they don't talk about stuff.
No.
you know, Spock had a fiance or a wife or whatever T'Pring was that nobody knew about on the Enterprise. Nobody knew his dad was the famous Vulcan ambassador. Nobody knew he had this half-brother named Cybok. He doesn't talk about his family. And I really like James Frayn's performance as Sarek in this episode. It's really hard to you know, follow Mark Leonard.
It's true.
But there were a couple moments here where I thought just like his face, the way like he's acting with his eyes, that I was like, man, I don't know if it was intentional or if it's just a coincidence, but it felt very Mark Leonard-ish. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that the actor James Frayn, I'm sure that he's gone and watched, you know, Journey to Babel. He's watched The Search for Spock and and studied Mark Leonard.
And I think it was a very worthy performance. This Sarek is very much growing on me. I think my initial reaction to the character in the first episode was a little tentative, because, wait, what is Sarek even doing in this? How is this going to work into continuity? But like you pointed out, these Vulcans, especially Ambassador Sarek's family, don't volunteer any information that is not pertinent to the current situation. So why would he mention these other family members when they're not relevant to what's going on?
Yeah, no, like, they would never talk about this. We would only know it if they made a prequel show and showed it to us. Like they're doing. Just one other thing to talk about. You know, last week we ended on a kind of a weird Twilight Zone-ish cliffhanger almost type ending, where we have the character Lieutenant Stamets staring at himself in the mirror, walking away from the mirror. There's a delay, and then his reflection turns around and walks away. There's been a lot of mirror references in the show. We have people reading the book Through the Looking Glass. We have, in the first episode, the Klingon T'Kuvma tells the Klingon Cole, you know, your deformed white skin, I see that as a mirror. I see myself reflected into it. We have an episode that opens with Michael Burnham trying on a uniform and looking at it
in the mirror.
In a holographic mirror. So, Jeff, what do you know about mirrors and Star Trek? Is there any connection there?
Well, there have been several connections dating all the way back to the original series 50 years ago with the episode Mirror, Mirror. Yep. Everybody likes to bring up bearded Spock is evil. If you put a beard on someone, that makes them evil.
Yeah, it's iconic.
It is. And so we have also had Mirror Universe episodes. You could count yesterday's Enterprise-ish, but that's not the Mirror Universe. It's simply an alternate timeline. In Deep Space Nine, we got the Mirror Universe with Kira as the intendant over the station. And then in Enterprise, we had Through a Mirror Darkly, which was excellent.
Yeah, I think there's been nine, if I'm remembering correctly, there's been nine Mirror Universe episodes.
Episodes with the bulk of them being from Deep Space Nine.
And also a very cool Mirror Universe comic that's out right now, where you get to see the Mirror Universe version of the Next Generation characters. And we see Lieutenant Stamets again in this episode, and he's a little bit different than how he's not the the prickly asshole that he's always been. He's kind of a chilled out hippie.
That's very true. Just his mannerisms, some of the phraseology he uses. He makes drug references several times.
Yeah, he talks about doing speed. He uses the adjective groovy.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you think this is a Mirror Universe infiltrator?
If it's not a Mirror Universe Stamets, which I think would be a really interesting twist, if the Stamets we saw in the mirror was our Stamets, and the Stamets we got was the mirror Stamets, either that or his exposure to the Spore network has done something to him on a fundamental level. I mean, he's obviously not in the same constant mood we saw him in before. He's not quite so prickly. When someone suggests an idea that isn't his, he readily goes for it. This is not the same character. So something has changed.
Yeah.
Is he a different Stamets? I don't
know. And Lorca even points that out. He says, you seem to be in a much better mood than typically are. You know, basically saying, most of the time when I come down here to engineering, you and I get in an argument and we yell at each other. And now you're being very chill. What's up with that? And he mentions, my trip down the mycelium highway mellowed me out, man. It was groovy.
Yeah.
So, I'm curious how, we know that the show is headed towards the Mirror Universe. That's Jonathan Frakes, who has directed an episode, he let the cat out of the bag at a convention appearance recently, and Alex Kurtzman has gone on record and kind of confirmed that. I'm curious how they're going to do it, though. I thought Enterprise had a really good way of doing the Mirror Universe, but without it affecting the continuity at all, because the entire two-part story was set in the Mirror Universe. If you do like crossover-ish stuff, that does seem kind of weird for continuity with the original series.
And it will be interesting to see. You know there's a lot of love for the original series and the crew and cast, because you mentioned yourself to me earlier, the little details, the tribble on Lorca's desk, the flag from the Star Trek technical manual, those things. So maybe they're looking at the Mirror Universe as another, let's do another tip of the hat to the original series. We've changed a lot, but let's go back and look at something familiar. But what I want to know is, with such a darker wartime Starfleet, what is the mirror version? What are we? Will we get something that's a shade darker still, or will they flip it on its ear, and we end up with something a little closer in tone to the Star Trek we're used to?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm not sure exactly how they would do it. I'm not sure if it's something they might be setting up for season two, because we know that the writers are preparing stories for season two, and they've said it's not going to be Klingon War. That'll be resolved in the remaining Nine episodes. I do think that they have a cool opportunity to bring back a lot of the characters they've killed off, though. I think we could see, like, evil Mirror Universe Captain Philippa Georgiou, and we can also see Mirror Universe Commander Landry, who, instead of being a dickhead, would be, like, a really nice, sweet character.
And something that made me wonder about that is, in IMDb, unless they've changed it over the last few days, Rika Sharma was listed as having been in 15 episodes rather than two.
Yeah.
So perhaps there's still a few episodes with Commander Landry we've yet to see.
Yeah, but IMDb is...
True.
Typically very accurate with anything that, like, has already come out, been released, and, you know, it's been out for a couple months. We know everything about it. As far as, like, things that are still in development or things that... are currently on the air, but we haven't seen all of it, they can make some pretty big mistakes. But one theory I've seen online is that Captain Lorca is such an atypical captain, whereas most Federation captains are the very, you know, idealistic, great representation of the Roddenberry idea of humanity in the future. What if Lorca is an infiltrator from the Mirror Universe? I don't know if we'll actually see that, but I'd be curious what, like, the... If this isn't the Lorca from the normal universe, they could do a thing where they set him up to be eventually turned to the villain of the show.
It's true.
They could kill him off and then keep Jason Isaacs on the show by having the true Lorca in. Or maybe this is the true Lorca and the Mirror Universe guy is going to replace him in the next season. I don't know. What do you think about Lorca in this episode, though?
You know, I had a grudging, you know, respect for Lorca up till this point, thinking, yes, this is the kind of captain that makes the hard decisions and does the things that need to be done in wartime. But while I am still in Lorca's corner, and I think, yes, he's continuing to do what needs to be done to win the war, that one particular decision that he makes in suggesting a replacement for Sarek, that seemed ridiculously self-serving. Like, I think Lorca knew that that was a one-way trip.
Yeah, so just to elaborate on what we're talking about here, in case you don't remember, the Admiral character that we've been seeing on the show a lot, Admiral Katrina Cornwall, actually pays Discovery a visit. We, you know, find out more about her friendship with Lorca. It appears to be a friendship with benefits.
Yes.
They have a night of intimacy together, and they have a falling out where she realizes, you know, you act like you have your shit together, but you're a broken, unstable, dangerous man. And he freaks out. We've never seen Lorca so vulnerable before, but he's scared that his superior is going to take his command away from him. And he's on the verge of tears. He's like, no, don't take my ship. She's all I got. And she has that line where, I can't tell if this is actually you being genuine or if you're trying to deceive me. But, yeah, he sends her on the mission that Sarek was going to go on to, where he's going to go talk to two Klingon houses that are supposedly kicked off of the ruling body of the Klingon Empire, and they're trying to find a way to end the war because they want to get rid of the Klingon Cole, who's currently running the show. Sarek can't go. Lorca comes up with the idea for Admiral Cornwall to go, and it's a dirty Klingon trick where her escorts are killed, her alien hosts are killed, and she is taken prisoner. Felt like something Romulans would do, or 23rd century Klingons, from what we know from the original series, they were much more treacherous. So they're definitely going in that TOS style type of approach with the Klingons. But yeah, so you think that Lorca intentionally sent her on this one way trip?
I think to
maintain his command.
I think so. I think so, because this was Lorca's Sisko moment from In the Pale Moonlight. He knew what needed to be done. He thinks he's the man to save the Federation, as long as he's in command of Discovery. Regardless of their prior relationship, Admiral Cornwell was going to take Discovery away from him. And I believe he talked her into going on that mission, knowing she wouldn't return, which presents a very much darker captain than we've ever seen before on Star Trek.
Yeah. One other thing, though, is that we don't know exactly what happened to him when he was captured and taken prisoner. We did see the Klingon Lorel torturing him with bright lights on his sensitive eyes. We didn't see too much of that scene. I'm wondering if he's been programmed as a sleeper agent or something, and maybe there is some manipulation from the Klingons that they used to get him to send that admiral. And then they end up with a high valuable prisoner.
Someone with plenty of knowledge of Starfleet's tactics and defenses. But you notice the thing that sent him over the edge was when she reached out and touched the scars. Now, were those scars from his captivity with the Klingons? Were those fresh scars? Or were those older scars?
Yeah, see, that's what I was thinking, that they were probably fresh, but we didn't, like, see him. The only torture we saw in that episode was when they were, you know, shining lights in his eyes, basically. Because mm-hmm. he has that photosensitivity, I believe they called it.
Yes, yes. And that's why he keeps the lights so low in his office.
Mm-hmm. And it works on a metaphorical level where he's always in the dark. Mm-hmm. We also know that he's willing to sacrifice people, though. He thinks he's in the right because he destroyed his ship and his entire crew. We know that that's actually how he received that injury, was he watched his previous command, the USS...
Buran,
yeah, named after the Soviet space shuttle. Mm-hmm. He watched it explode, the entire crew killed, and he escaped. I'm really curious how he pulled that off. I'm hoping we see that in a flashback at some point.
I want to know that too, because from what we know of Starfleet officers, take Matt Decker. You know, Decker's entire crew was killed, and that drove him mad.
Yeah.
So how is Lorca dealing with the fact that he sacrificed a crew? You know, has he really made peace with that? Is that really something he can live with? So,
yeah, and Decker went mad after he failed to save the lives of his mm-hmm. of his crew. Lorca intentionally ended the lives of his crew.
Exactly.
He thought he was doing them a favor. So you'd think that it would be more crazy thing to cope with. Mm-hmm. But I can't make up my mind on Lorca, and it's one of the things I like about the show, is I'm so curious to see where it goes with it, because I can still see him being a character who sticks around, who's a good guy, who has some redemption in the end. He's obviously done some bad stuff, but I can see him, you know, doing some self-sacrifice or doing something at some point that makes it all forgivable. Or I can see him just having like a total villain turn, and maybe he turns into Garth of Izar, I don't know.
Right, and either of those would be fascinating to watch. And Star Trek has explored this theme before. There was the episode of Next Generation with the super soldier, Roga Danar. What happens when the war is over? What do you do with those soldiers? Does Lorca represent, you know, the rough people who are willing to make those hard decisions? When the war is over, what does he do? What's left for him in Starfleet? So,
but you gotta figure, I mean, this war has only been going on for 7 months, so he had to have been doing something before then.
That's true.
But he was also a captain who hadn't watched his crew die, so maybe he wasn't the general on the battlefield type captain until that happened.
Well, we saw that turn with Archer.
Yeah,
Archer was uncomfortable with Mako's aboard, and then the first thing he tells the captain of NXO2,
yeah, Hernandez. Yeah, like, you definitely want some Mako on board. Yeah, that's a good point. So, it's weird because Enterprise, it kind of... Archer did some stuff in Enterprise that kind of bothered me, but it kind of showed over the course of the four seasons, you kind of see how, yeah, like, this naive explorer going into space for the first time, and then he encounters things like the Zindi and the Romulans and all this different stuff, all these different trials, and eventually he kind of becomes like the type of captain archetype that we see with, you know, later, with like Captain Kirk or Captain Pike or what have you. It's weird that Discovery is kind of retreading that, where we see a captain who Jason Isaacs, the actor, has described Lorca as being, yeah, he's probably the most fucked up captain, which I certainly agree with after watching the episodes with him.
Pretty true.
But I'm wondering if kind of the plan with Discovery is eventually we get to a Kirkish type captain, maybe Saru or Michael Burnham become captain of the Discovery, and we get to that TOS style captain archetype. It seems like Enterprise kind of already did that, and now we're doing it again on Discovery. But
well, the thing that popped into my head is when you said, "Well, we saw, you know, a naive cap," and the funny part is that partially describes Georgiou. Captain Georgiou was a consummate professional, an excellent Starfleet captain. But what happened in that pilot episode? She was entirely wrong not to take Burnham's advice. She was following Starfleet's ideals and protocols, but in that particular moment, you needed a Hawk. And now we're at war. And that raises some interesting philosophical questions. You know, when do you hold to your beliefs, and when do you deviate because reality is at odds with those beliefs? So, you know, Georgiou is more of a Picard-type captain.
Yeah.
And Lorca is a little more like a really, really dark Kirk.
Lorca is, like, Trip in season 3 of Enterprise.
Right.
He's like...
They blew up Florida.
He's like, yeah, none of that tiptoeing around this time, Captain. We're not going to be following none of that non-interference shit T'Pol's always trying to shove down our throats, are we? Like we're going over there to kick ass. So, yeah, we're definitely getting into Trip Season 3 with Lorca.
And, you know, it makes perfect sense if he's lost a crew. And that makes me wonder, you know, you brought up, maybe Lorca wasn't like this till he lost his crew. He's got a room full of weapons that he sits in the ship.
Yeah.
He refers to Starfleet officers as soldier when we've never seen that before in Starfleet. Kirk said it once in Errand of Mercy. I'm a soldier, not a diplomat. But in Next Generation, every time somebody brings up the M-word, it's Starfleet is not a military. Lorca believes he is a soldier, and his people are soldiers. When did that happen? Is that, like you pointed out, since Baran? Or has Lorca always been sort of a hawk among doves?
And one thing that we found out tonight about the show, which I've kind of suspected about the way it's structured and the way the season one story is structured, that things will be explained. You know, we had, like, this weird kind of mind-meld connection between Burnham and Sarek that we had never seen before. This episode, like, it really, like, delved into the details. It got into pretty much just a scene of somebody just explaining it to the other characters and explaining it to the audience.
Right.
Like, yeah, here's exactly what happened. It's called a soul graph. This is how it works. This is why it happened. So I do think it's likely that we will see a flashback or at least get a conversation that gives us sheds a lot more light on the destruction of his ship. But, yeah, how cool would it be to have, like, a flashback to Lorca in those days? And he's just, like, really friendly, smiling. He's, like, gossiping with his first officer. And then all of a sudden, like, they're attacked by Klingons where somehow, like, he's trying to, you know, repair something in engineering and he gets stuck with having to make, like, the choice, okay, I can destroy the ship and eat. I'll survive, but they'll all die, and it'll save them from being captured. And it's, you have, like, that moment where you see him make that choice, and you can tell us, it's like, this is the hardest thing he's ever done in his life. And after that, he's the hardened, hawkish captain that we've seen in the show so far.
That is that's a good point. And I don't know why it popped into my head, but the dilithium pod in Court Martial.
Oh!
When Ben Finney is ejected from the ship in the dilithium pod.
That would be so perfect. Yeah, if they did something with that pod, yes. Like, that, and that's something that, like, only, like, Star Trek TOS fans would know.
Right.
But we would be like, oh yeah, I know exactly what just happened. Like, that's great.
Mm-hmm. And what we don't know, do we know for a fact that Lorca intended to survive? Did he ever say he intended to save himself? Because if he was working, say, in the dilithium pod, and the dilithium pod was ejected as the ship was destroyed, he might have been an unintentional survivor. And some of this angst, some of this violence that he has inside him might be a reaction to not having gone down with his crew.
And we know he has guilt, because that's why he doesn't. That's the true reason why he won't repair his eyes. That is the pain he chooses, as established in last week's episode, Choose Your Pain. So, yeah, he definitely has some guilt issues there. I just want to see that scene where there's this ship explosion and, like, he can't look away from it. Like as it's, like, burning his retinas.
Oh, I hadn't made that connection, but you're absolutely right. That could be exactly what happened.
Yeah. So, I don't know what a matter-antimatter explosion would look like, but I think it's likely it's something you probably shouldn't stare at.
Yeah, not without a nice pinhole camera or maybe some of those spot glasses from Is There in Truth No Beauty?
Yeah. Anything else in this episode stand out to you?
I liked a lot of the little background details. The food processor had me chuckling.
I love that they still eat burritos.
Yes, they do. And the other thing that I noticed, and it's not as overwhelming as it is in that other sci-fi series that's popular right now, but there are, like, groovy, the word groovy. Where does Lieutenant Stamets pull up 200-year-old pop culture slang terms from? You know, burritos with roasted salsa, that's still a thing in Discovery. It's interesting.
You would think if the word groovy ever showed up in Star Trek, it would have been in The Way to Eden.
Yes. Hey, brother.
But, no, everyone on the Discovery is a, what do they call them? If you're a square?
Yeah, Herbert.
Herbert, yeah. Herbert. Yeah, this is a ship full of Herberts.
Herbert.
So, except for Stamets.
Yes. And, see, that's what's interesting. With this heel face turn with Stamets, it's probably something to do with the spores that we discussed earlier, but also remember...
You're saying he's high on mushrooms.
Exactly. Stamets' big thing, the thing that just got his goat when you first met him, was that he was a scientist on a military ship being asked to do military missions. Now that he's kind of mellowed out a little bit, Burnham brings him something that's not a military mission. Let's go save Sarek. Groovy. Let's save Sarek. You know, what do you mean you can hook up to his brain, man? That's groovy.
Yeah.
You know?
He's not like how he's been in previous episodes where he's like, are you trying to show us how smart you are? What are you doing with your mouth? That's weird. Like, he's not being like the total jerk.
Exactly. So, he's just sort of abiding.
But he does seem like, but we know of how this alternate universe, the mirror universe, works. He does seem like he could be the Stamets counterpart.
Very much could be.
He seems like, if he was like this, like, cool, like, groovy hippie type guy, he could have been trying to escape the tyranny of the Terran Empire.
That's very true.
And so, the first thing he says in last week's episode, if I'm right, when he wakes up, is he says, like, you know, did it work? And then he starts laughing maniacally. So.
That's a great point, too. One of those little things that, in hindsight, will make perfect sense once the reveal happens.
You know, it's weird that we have a Star Trek show that is so heavily serialized, even though, like, I know Enterprise and DS9 dip their toes into that.
Yes.
But we have a Star Trek show in the age of things like podcasting, where people can talk about the episodes each and every week with the entire world. And having the serialized nature, we are wondering, you know, well, what's the deal with Lorca? Are we going to find out more about his past? Is Stamets from the Mirror Universe? And it's cool that they're writing it in this modern way. I'm a huge fan of the traditional episodic nature of Star Trek, the you know, story of the week, the self-contained story. But I like seeing these modern serialized arcs just because it is so fun to have these conversations.
And I think serialized is where Star Trek needed to be. It's much more interesting when you're following the development of the characters and things change from episode to episode.
Yeah, I mean, we've had literally hundreds of episodes that are self-contained stories. And if you watch Voyager and Enterprise, they were kind of starting to run out of ideas. How many recycled holodeck episodes did we see?
Yeah.
Like, did we really need Fairhaven on Voyager? You know, did we really need to see another holodeck fun time session go wrong? But
one wonders why the Starfleet continues to put them on the ships at that
like,
point.
How many Prime Directive stories have we had? Like, let's do things a little differently. So, I'm digging Discovery, and like I keep saying, every episode I like it more than the last one. Every week I'm saying, well, this was my favorite one so far. I think I've said that every week.
Right, and I'm going to agree with you on this one. This one, it's the serialized, it's getting us deeper and deeper into the lore and the whys and the wherefores of all these characters and the war that they're in.
And if there is eventually an explanation of why Klingon ships look wrong, or why there's holograms all over the place, but we don't see those again, I would really dig that. But yeah, I still have my fingers crossed that eventually we see a TOS-style augment virus infected Klingon, and he's on a Matt Jeffries D7.
I agree completely. And one theory a friend of mine tossed at me today that I mentioned before we started recording was that perhaps the reason we haven't seen a traditional Klingon ship yet is that the vessels that we see, all of which are different from one another. I don't think we've seen two ships of the same class yet. These are the ships that belong to the Klingon houses, that are part of the Klingon houses, and what we recognize as the Klingon Imperial Navy is not yet a thing, or is a thing off-screen that we haven't seen.
Yeah, and that would actually make a lot of sense, because I think the intention is that we have the 24 Klingon houses that we're aware of, and I think there's more than 24 houses. They say that there's 24 great houses. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, like, well, that's the council, is the 24. Right. But, you know, it's kind of how medieval societies have worked.
Where houses greater, houses minor. Yeah.
Or that's how Game of Thrones is set up, where you have, you know, different wardens, and then they have people loyal to them with smaller families, less powerful families. But if we do have all these different Klingon designs, it kind of makes sense that after, you know, where we left off the Klingons on Enterprise, they kind of do fall apart. They establish that there's been very little contact with the Klingons for 100 years, and after the events of Star Trek Discovery, they do become the Klingon Empire we know of the original series.
Right. This is the catalyzing event that brings them back together as an empire.
Yeah, so the potential is there to, you know, fit all the pieces in and make it this cohesive story that works with canon and is, you know, hopefully, you know, pretty compelling to fans and new fans alike.
And it also lays the groundwork for the Klingon Cold War that we're familiar with from TOS through Star Trek VI.
Yeah.
There had to be a hot war to set up the Cold War.
Yeah, and they've made references to, you know, there was a big conflict with the Klingons. You know, that Donatu 5 was mentioned in The Trouble with Tribbles, that was a battle. That they also reference in, I think it was the second episode of the show, The Battle of the Binary Stars.
Yes.
Takuvma brings that up.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So, yeah, we know that it was always implied that there is a big conflict with the Klingons. They're in the FASA stuff. They had the four-year war.
The 4 years war was the war with the Klingons that Kirk mentions when he's on the Republic and all that sort of thing.
So, but it looks like Discovery is going to establish that as a one-year war. But. And then we'll be on to a different story in Season 2. I'd love to see the Tholians pop up.
Yes, the Tholians, the Gorn, perhaps?
You know, Gorn are tricky.
You're right, because that was the first time they were seen.
It's okay to, like, if you found a skeleton on a planet and you decide to, like, take it and keep it with you, that works. But if you make first contact with the Gorn, that's going to be hard to explain.
They did show up in the Mirror episode of Enterprise.
Yeah, so if we get into the Mirror universe, you know, no rules. You can put as many Gorn in there as you want. But I think that's going to do it for Episode 6, Lethe. But we'll be talking about Episode 7 next week. The title, Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad. Another classic TOS-style enticing episode title.
That's a great title.
Yeah, so I'm definitely looking forward to seeing that. And Jeff, I want to thank you for showing up tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and you're always welcome to join me and Dave anytime you feel so inclined.
Outstanding. It sounds like a great time.
So we will talk about Episode 7 next week, and until then, live long and prosper, y'all. Thank all of you so much for checking out this installment of Tex Trek. I hope you enjoyed it. Please be sure to like our YouTube videos and subscribe to our channel. Audio-only version of episodes are available at our website, www.tex-trek.com. Please check out our site, especially if you just want an audio-only podcast. We have that available for you. Y'all can also keep up with us online. You can follow us on Twitter, at TXTrek, or you can check us out on Facebook at www.facebook.com/tex-trek. Please, by all means, let us know what you think by dropping a comment anywhere you see fit. We definitely want to hear your feedback. Let us know what you liked and what you would like to see more of.
what you would like to see differently going forward. If you want to email me directly, go ahead. I can be reached at fatheryactual@text-trek.com. Thank all y'all again. Take care.